right, welcome to Season 2, Episode 21, also known as Episode 53 of the Retro Game Club podcast. And with me, as always, someone else who just loves fireworks a week or two before, Hugh.
Oh, yeah, nothing I enjoy more than sitting out, feeding mosquitoes, being around lots of people in the heat, and watching stuff explode.
It's your birthright, right?
Yeah.
At my house, they really started. It's like a month before now, and like a month after.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the amateur stuff in my neighborhood is pretty bad because I live in a neighborhood where there is no village. So you can pretty much anything that's not illegal statewide is legal here. And that includes homemade fireworks, apparently.
Yeah.
But on the plus side, I can like build stuff in my house without a permit.
Yeah, that is nice. And didn't you say your neighbors like burned their furniture in the backyard one time?
Oh, not one time. No, not one time. So I have two separate burning furniture stories with my neighbors. Sorry to get off topic here, but yeah, they were cleaning up the house and there was this old couch sitting on the curb, and I think they were hoping like the scrappers would take it. It was out there for at least a week, maybe 2 weeks. And then one day I just saw them in the backyard cutting up with an axe and burning it. And then, this is not a joke, on Christmas morning, they were in their backyard burning a old wood bed frame.
Wow. So if they're doing that kind of stuff outside of the house, you gotta wonder what's going on inside of the house.
Yeah, I have some theories. Now, the bed was really curious because I'm pretty sure maybe you could get a new bed for Christmas, but I don't think anyone delivers furniture on Christmas. So why was the old one being burned Christmas morning and not like the day before or the day after? It just was more questions than answers.
You'll never know.
I'm not going to ask, but it was pretty foul.
What have you been up to?
That's a good question. Oh, you know, I game-wise, I started playing the South Park RPG on PlayStation 4.
Okay.
Have you played that? It's a sort of turn-based role-playing game based on South Park. It's really just sort of like a interactive South Park episode.
Is it, what's it called?
It's South Park something or other.
It's not Fractured Butthole?
Yes.
It is that
the second one?
Yes, I think.
It's the second one because this is how bad I am about not opening games when I get them. So I got that on sale really cheap at probably a Target some time ago. Really cheap, like $19.99. Okay. And on the box, there was a sticker that said free download code for the first game, whatever it was called.
Yeah, I forget.
And I opened up the package this week. That code expired 2 years ago.
Wow.
So I don't know how long this game's been on my shelf, but apparently plus 2 years.
It got really good reviews.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's actually a pretty good game, and I like it. The one downside is I cannot read any of the text. I actually have, like, pretty much 20/20 vision. Like, I get my eyes checked every year and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's on a big screen TV that's like 20 feet away from me. So constantly, like, you find an item and it says, hey, you found so-and-so. But it's like 4-point text, it looks like. It looks like text that I could read if I was sitting 8 inches away from a monitor, which must be how they tested it. And I know it's the same thing. Like, Final Fantasy VII Remake, the text was kind of small. I have mentioned, like, playing through the Trails of Cold Steel games. Part 3 just came out on Switch recently. I played it on PlayStation 4, so I didn't start the Switch version yet. And all of it's small text. Like, if you're sitting 20 feet away from your TV, you're going to struggle to read these games. And I don't understand why games, especially as, like, people who grew up on video games are all, you know, pushing 50 at this point, if not over, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand why video games don't have, like, just a large font option. I'm not saying make it default, just, like, if you said, hey, you're going to play another game like the South Park game and the font is going to be the same size, I would probably pass.
They actually, everyone could take a drink because I'm mentioning the new God of War game for like the fifth episode in a row. But and I haven't played that game since it was released, but they actually had to release a patch for it because so many people complained about the text.
Yeah. And again, I think it's that the developers are all playing on monitors that are, you know, a couple inches from their face. And it never occurs to them that, like, you look staring at a 48-inch monitor, whatever monitor size developers get, I assume something large, right? Mm-hmm. If you're sitting 6 inches from it, it's not at all the home experience.
No, no. But you would think some of the QA people might mention that to them.
Yeah, they might. It could be the same thing, though. I picture QA people as basically just sitting in a beanbag chair, also 6 inches from the screen, just with, like, feeding tubes connected to them.
One can dream.
Yeah, video game tester sounds like the worst job on earth when you really start to look into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not like, all right, I'm going to play this game and then give feedback. You just play through it normally and give feedback, and it's going to be awesome games, right? It's a lot of like, hey, here's the new SpongeBob game. You need to run into every wall.
Yeah. Every day, all day. Yeah. Over and over.
That's all you're doing, is just running into every wall, every corner, trying to break the game.
Yep.
Oh, you notice anything else?
Let's see. I know I'm a bit late to the game, but I kind of really dove into Twitch the past week or two. They kind of have a whole retro era. You could discover some players playing. And so I discovered some people. And I don't do the chat or anything like that. I just kind of watch some speedrunners do what they're doing. And it's really interesting to watch them try certain things over and over again. Until they get it, you know, muscle memory in. And, so if any of our listeners has any recommendations of anyone I should be watching on it, please send them our way. The only other thing is I finally finished Maneater, that shark game.
Okay.
Here's the thing with that game. It is a grindy exploration shark building game. Okay.
Okay.
If that makes sense. And a lot of people complain about it because they say it's too grindy, but that's literally like eating people and things is what you do. That is the grind, you know? So if you're not into that, this might not be your game, but I enjoyed it. It was kind of funny. At one point, one of the things you can enhance in your shark character is how long you can last out of water. And I kind of maxed that out. And I found a rave on the beach and ate every single person, including the DJ, I think. So that was kind of fun. Little a point in my life there. But yeah, PTO starts for me today for the next 11 days. So I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. Did you see that they're going to reboot Beavis and Butthead, but with a Gen Z spin on it?
I'm excited about this.
I think it has potential. I would like to see. I wish it was on now. Like, I kind of wish I could see how Beavis and Butthead handle quarantine.
They've got to touch on it. You know what I mean?
Or getting thrown out of stores due to not wearing a face mask. Or actually, they probably would go along with things. It would be the people around them that would be funnier, I suppose.
Did you watch that last season? Maybe like what? Oh, geez, like 9 or 8 years ago now? Oh,
yeah, it was a while ago, yeah, yeah. Well, because like Twilight was, they were making fun of Twilight, so that had to be new enough that Twilight jokes still made sense.
That was a really funny episode, and also the tech support episode was just an instant classic.
Yeah, I like the tech support one.
But, yeah, I'm excited for that. Maybe I'll pick a Beavis and Butthead game sometime soon.
Yeah, if you have MAME, you should try the extremely rare but also awful arcade brawler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never tried that.
Yeah, it's usually at Midwest Gaming Classic, and I don't know, there's one or two working cabinets in the world. I don't remember, but it's also a Galloping Ghost arcade, of course.
Yeah,
and awful. Just what I can see why that game was canceled.
But should we dive in? We actually have quite a bit of news here.
Yeah, a lot of news here. So NVIDIA engineer wrote a driver for the Raspberry Pi that can run Quake 3 at over 100 frames per second at 720p resolution.
And this is even, this is on the Raspberry Pi 1, 2, and 3, and 0. He didn't even write this for the 4.
Yeah, it, the demo video is on the Pi 3 Model B.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean the driver can't work with everything else, but just this particular performance benchmark was on the 3.
Mm-hmm. And he says at 1080p, it could at least run at 70 frames per second. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, which would also be pretty impressive. Yeah, I don't know how hot that Raspberry Pi is getting. This shows a lot of potential for what you could do on these things.
It doesn't even look like he has a fan on it. He definitely has a heat sink on it, but he doesn't have a fan on it.
Yeah, I mean, now this game is, I don't know, probably 20 years old now. But I mean, compared to what, I mean, my first Pi that I had, you could barely run Doom.
Yeah, there was still a lot of tweaking that needed to happen. But yeah, that's really cool, really impressive. Hopefully he keeps that going, because that'll help every, you know, not just Quake, it helps everything, you know?
Yeah.
On Ars Technica, boom shakalaka, how the original NBA Jam caught fire through chaos. This is a great video interview with the guy who created most of NBA Jam, and it goes through what inspired him to become a video game coder, to his favorite games, his first games, and a lot of video on how NBA Jam just came to be. A lot of video I couldn't believe still existed, and he went through what worked and what didn't work when they demoed the units and stuff like that, and how he made it so since he's from Michigan, Detroit plays Chicago, if Chicago ever shoots at the buzzer, they miss every time.
Yeah, I think that's a known thing. I think it's been around for a while that people have known about that.
But just, he seems like a nice guy. It's a really fun video. Even if you don't like basketball, if you like arcade stuff, this is definitely a video for you. And it's not very long either. They really get to the point and not a lot of fluff in this. They get into a lot of fun details. So I can't recommend this one enough. Again, that's on Ars Technica and in our show notes.
Yeah. You definitely don't have to be a basketball fan to enjoy NBA Jam.
Yeah. Fan-made radio drama Sonic and Tails Lightspeed Dashes onto YouTube. This I did not get to listen to yet.
I did not, because it sounds kind of weird.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like it's like a gateway drug to being a furry.
Yeah, okay, I can see that. I like some old-timey radio stuff. Is that how it's done, like old-timey radio?
I don't know. I haven't listened to it yet. This is the one thing this week that I didn't get a chance to do before the show. But I wanted it in here regardless.
Yeah, I'm listening to it right now. And yeah, it is like an old-time radio. Like old-timey radio. It's pretty cool.
Cool. Nice. Maybe I prejudged it. I will hold judgment until I listen to it.
Yeah, I think I will probably give this a listen while I'm working sometime this weekend.
Cool. Nice. This next one I almost skipped over because the title is really lame, but it's actually kind of cool. This is on Collider.com, Why Retro Gaming Needs a Revolution. And it really just talks about how, like, you know, books really haven't evolved. You know, yeah, there's ebooks and stuff now, but you still consume them the same way. And videos really haven't evolved that much. Like, you could still, you know, find VHSs even if you want to. And most stuff is re-released over and over again, from VHS all the way to Blu-ray 4K. And that doesn't really happen with video games, where, like, there's just thousands of games that there's not a legal way to play them right now on a Switch or something. Mm-hmm. And he makes a good point where there's too many and not enough ways to play retro video games. Too many meaning, like, yeah, you can install RetroArch and download, you know, every game ever made, but that might not be ideal, and it's not really legal. So what are we supposed to do? You know, so he's just pretty much saying that video game companies need to think about this and plan ahead, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And again, the article is only like two or three, and even two pages. So an easy read. Denofgeek.com. How Arcade 1UP plans to revive arcade culture.
Yeah, it seems like a bad time to revive a culture that involves a lot of people standing in a small room together. But.
Yeah, and it's just a very brief, I don't even know if I would call this an interview. It's an article with lines from an interview, I guess.
Yeah, I would call it a ad, is what I would call it.
Kinda, yeah. But pretty much they say like, yeah, we started this thing, it's blowing up, the pandemic happened, and we are really afraid, and so we just picked some cabs to release right, you know, right all at the same time, and we weren't able, you know, they didn't have to lay anyone off, they're doing just fine, which is, you know, good for them and stuff like that, because I really like what they're doing, but you're right, this is kind of an advertisement.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. It is nice to see that they have a Ms. Pac-Man cabinet. I don't remember seeing that before. Because Ms. Pac-Man has some, like, weird, hazy licensing situation.
True, yeah, yeah. So I do wonder what's in there. And I wonder if they're, like, what hardware they use. You know, if it's the same hardware and everything. You know, how accurate is it? I actually have never played one of these in person.
I don't think I have either. I just assume it's, like, a... Given the types of games they're running, I just assume it's a low-grade Android machine.
Yeah, yeah. But hopefully it's not too laggy or anything like that. Do you want to download RetroArch on Steam?
Yeah. Does that make life easier?
I like that they're doing this, but I kind of don't get it. So now you can do this. And it comes with 10 cores, and you can't download more cores. They're just saying, like, hey, this is kind of a different... They almost, like, ported RetroArch to Steam. So they're saying, like, hey, just let us start here because we're going to get a ton of bugs. So we just want to make it maintainable for us for now. So you could do Nintendo 64, PlayStation, Atari, Game Boy, Game Boy Advance... NES, Genesis, and Final Burn Neo, which I think is Neo Geo. What's Chronos? Do you know?
I do not. It is...
Other than, isn't that where Superman is from?
Chronos is a fork of the OUY-based emulator, which is, so it's just Sega Saturn.
Oh, okay. I know, Chronos is where the Klingons are from. I lost some nerd cred there.
Yes, I believe this would be a Sega Saturn emulator.
Cool. Well, that's nice that they're confident you have a fast enough computer to emulate that. Is your Dreamcast running out of memory at all right now?
Oh yeah, constantly. I constantly run out of game. Constantly run into games that say they need more RAM. So yeah, this is our. I think I was going to post this in the notes too. Maybe you did first. But yeah, there's this guide on how to add an extra 16 meg of RAM to your Dreamcast to bring it up to 32 meg of RAM, which of course no games can actually use. But this apparently comes in handy for some emulators.
For homebrew, so you could just start making new games that would use all this. A lot of people were hoping this would make it so you could run Naomi stuff on there, but Naomi has more video RAM and sound RAM, so...
So you could make homebrew games that only other people who've done this mod could play.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, it's neat. I like projects like this. Outside of just like the intellectual curiosity of doing it, I don't know what good it is.
I'm a person that upgrades my Dreamcast with everything possible. I am not going to do this.
Some blocky Final Fantasy VII figures are coming out soon. I guess you can order them on Amazon.
Yeah, they're PS1 style. I think they look pretty neat. They have, you know, like 15 polygons each.
It is $64 for the set of 7 figures.
That's a bit much. A little bit too much for that.
Yeah, it depends how much you plan to play with them, I guess. Like make which little is, scenes.
Which is nothing. They all just sit on a shelf somewhere. Modern controllers on your Dreamcast and Saturn. So there's a new thing called Wingman SD that is pretty much a 2.4 gigahertz Bluetooth adapter for your Dreamcast. This guy on the SaturnJunkyard.blogspot.com. We've definitely never been here before. Mm-hmm. But shout out to this article because it's not bad. He tries out, I would say, 4 or 5 different controllers, like the PS4 controller, some of the Retrobit and other controllers, and gives like a 1 second difference between them and pretty much says the PS4 controller works the best. Mm-hmm. You can remap your buttons and stuff with this thing. It looks pretty nice.
Yeah, because PS4 controllers are going to be, you know, easier to find than original Dreamcast or Saturn controllers. And you just might prefer it too, right? And Saturn Junkyard's a good site. They do a podcast. There's no, like, fixed schedule. I get the impression it's like whenever they feel like they release a podcast about Saturn stuff.
Oh, cool. Nice. But yeah, I did not know about this thing, and then I did. Again, it's called the Wingman. If I already didn't have too many Saturn controller thingies, then I'd probably get this. I would say one of the bigger news items of the week. PS2 hack runs games on burned DVD discs with no mod chip required. This is a first.
Yeah, so this exploits a bug in the DVD player. Must cause some kind of buffer overflow, or I'm guessing.
Yeah, it opens a hole, and then you could just play the game.
Yeah, so you don't have to take your PS2 apart and solder in some random bit of hardware to play burned games with this.
Yeah, and he also, one of the first things he does is plays a SNES emulator on it.
Yeah, back to the point about there being like way too many ways to play old games.
Yeah. And he also points out that because this works, he sees no reason why this wouldn't work on the PS3 and the PS4, which is, to me, the bigger story, because they're newer, so far unhackable, to my knowledge, consoles, you know?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to try and see what happens. Maybe they figured this out, I don't know.
But could you imagine, like, downloading ISOs of PS4 games, like...
Well, you couldn't write. You don't really have a burner, right? Don't you would need a Blu-ray. You need a commercial Blu-ray burner because I don't think you can get a Blu-ray burner that. I thought consumer Blu-ray burners were lower capacity than what PS4 games were.
I don't think that's true anymore. I think it used to be true.
Okay.
But still, it's like, well, I guess I have to buy 10 hard drives to store these 4 games. Like, you actually lose money at that point.
Yeah. Let's see here. I'm trying to find the cheapest. So if I look at, like, okay. So you can buy an LG Blu-ray burner for $60. It's LG, so it'll break in a week. Right? 14x write speed. I don't know what that means.
That's not too bad.
For DVD, that sounds terrible. I can't get it to... I can't read where it says what size the maximum is. So I don't know. I could be completely wrong or thinking of, you know, players from the zeros.
Yeah, the first ones, I think, were only single layer, and then they went into dual layer after that. But again, you have to buy the media and or store it on your hard drive. And yeah, it just seems like...
Yeah, I mean, I've never looked at buying a Blu-ray burner just because there's cheaper ways to store backups. Like, the only reason I would get one would be to make backup discs. But at this point, like, you know, Amazon's 1 terabyte of backup storage is just a better option.
Oh, totally. Yeah. But back in the, you know, I want to say like, geez, it was probably 2008 where I got my first Blu-ray writer. I was doing, I mean, audio is pretty much my gig. And so for clients, I would give them a hard drive or pretty much have them buy a hard drive before we start the session. And then I would make a Blu-ray backup for myself. So there'd be 2 backups. So that's what I did for that. But back then, storage was still really expensive. But all right, sorry. I'm probably boring.
Yeah, no, no, I'm looking here. So at least one brand here claims it can do up to 128 gig burn.
Oh, that's pretty big, yeah.
Yeah. So that is still smaller than Final Fantasy VII Remake. But that would be most PlayStation games.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, that could be, I don't know if that's, yeah, it's Final Fantasy VII Remake, a lot of the data is probably compressed, so when it installs to whatever. All right, so Montezuma's Revenge for 8-bit Atari computers has gotten a little bit of a facelift by a fan. Have you played Montezuma's Revenge?
I have not.
I was going to, it's funny, like a few episodes ago, I was going to make this my Game Club pick. And then, I don't know, we had a topic, we had a guest that picked some games, so I didn't pick it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I got to go back and pick it again sometime. This is a very old school kind of
platformer,
it's hard to call
I'd
it a platformer. It is a platformer, but it's like each screen is like a completely independent. It's like Solomon's Key, sort of, where each screen is like its own independent puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they all tie together into like a bigger... Like, imagine Metroid was like a series of just single screen rooms instead of like a flowing map. That's kind of what this is, but each room has like some puzzles to solve. It's insanely difficult. And it back in the day, fun. It was ported to almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some speed runs of people who finish it. It's not a very long game, but oh man, is it impossible?
Yeah, this looks fun. I've always heard the name, but I've never played it.
Yeah, I don't know if you're supposed to use that name anymore. Like, I can't tell what phrases have been canceled. It seems like something that probably could go for a renaming.
Yeah, probably. We have another.
Like I said, I'm still surprised that there hasn't been like that punt, that there's been some article about why does Nintendo still have Punch Out, you know, on all the stores.
Yeah.
Let's see. ROM hack Super Mario Brothers 3, The Forgotten Worlds.
Yes. So it's a ROM hack of the Super Mario Brothers 2 that was released in Japan. So not Super Mario Brothers USA. Mm-hmm. And, there's a video for this and you can watch the video on YouTube that's not linked in this article, but this is far better than the original Super Mario Brothers 2. Far better. Really creative, pretty goofy. I give it 2 thumbs up. I would recommend everyone play this. So at the very least, watch some gameplay of it. Again, Super Mario Brothers 3, The Forgotten Worlds. It's on romhacking.net if you want to download and play it, or YouTube if you just want to watch a playthrough.
Yes, now you have to have a ROM of the original game.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it's a patch, of course. What else? Herzog Zwei is coming to Nintendo Switch. Normally, we don't talk about every single release that comes out, but this is one of my all-time favorite Genesis games, and it's getting a Switch port that includes like mini-map and stats on the side, so it's like, you know, pulling data. The mini-map is similar to the map you would get when you pause the game, so it might just be, you know, using code from the game to render the map, and apparently we'll have online play.
Huh. Cool.
If you want to play this against a friend.
Yeah, I will definitely be getting this.
Yeah, it's like a sort of almost launch Genesis game that you will not believe was like created in the first 6 months of the Genesis's life.
And somehow this game got by me. You know, you've mentioned this game so many times to me, and I just kept forgetting about it. So I'm excited to finally play it.
Yeah, I mean, like the dual, like the split screen, which you don't have to. If you're playing one player, you don't use split screen. I mean, you can if you want to, but you don't have to. Like just the dual scrolling layers where it's like I have two left and right side of the screen and they're scrolling and moving around independently. That's really hard to do.
Yeah, I could imagine.
And there's a VIC-20 clone coming.
Full size.
Yeah, full size. Yeah, for better or worse, full size.
It's got a USB and HDMI out too for your convenience.
And I think it's a pretty good game collection. It also has Commodore 64 games. So it's not just strictly, it looks like a VIC-20, but it's like more of a Commodore tribute computer.
And the, does it come with the joystick? Yeah, it comes with joystick.
Comes with the very old school joystick, yeah.
Yeah. The video that they, the advertisement for it uses part of the original advertisement with William Shatner in it, where he obviously has no idea what he's talking about. Like, he just showed up for the check, just read some words.
Yeah. So yeah, if you could play Zork on this, then it would be worth it. It looks like, I think I saw screens of, yeah, you can run, they show a basic programming window, so I guess the keyboard must work, and you must be able to write little programs and stuff for it. Like, Apple would never make an Apple II one of these. Like, that's what I want, is an Apple II version of this with a working keyboard.
Oh, that would be great.
It would be, but Apple is never going to do that.
No.
Ever.
No.
I mean, they have $1 trillion, like, literally. Mm-hmm. Why would they decide they needed to, you know, make a meager $1 million profit or whatever on something like this?
Yeah, yeah. I would buy that in a heartbeat, though.
Yeah, because it'd be really nice to have an Apple II emulator that was like no messing around. Just here's a computer, you play Apple games on it, and it has like an SD slot if you want to load more games.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Pac-Man's creator on the legacy, pizza, and the future. So on Game Informer, it's a nice little interview with the creator of Pac-Man for the 40th anniversary. And I think my favorite part about this interview is when he asks, like, what changed in Pac-Man after you tested it with people? And, you know, when they first released it, there weren't any power pellets and there weren't any tunnels. He said those were the two biggest things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big improvement. And the thing is, adding the power pellets is a pretty big change. Tunnels probably not a huge code change, but the pellets, I think, would be. And yet game would not have been successful without those.
And he actually brings up, he himself brings up one of my favorites, Pac-Man 256. So you'll have to read the article to know what he thinks about it. We have a an unplanned accidental beverage segment. Probably first and only time we'll ever do that.
Yeah, Pac-Man sake, which I'm sure I mispronounced. You know, I had a New Year's resolution to get into sake. Like, I've really never been a huge fan. I feel like maybe I need to try a few different varieties and see if there's one I actually like. I don't know if this is going to be any good, but it seems like a good excuse to try some.
I like the bottles.
I think a lot of people will buy it and never open it, which is a shame.
So I have a friend in Japan and who I messaged to see, because you could pre-order this now and online, but they would only ship within Japan.
Okay.
And so I asked and they won't. It's illegal to send alcohol from Japan to the U.S.
Yeah, I believe that.
So for any of our listeners that are doing traveling to Japan, hit me up.
But yeah, but the way these bottles look, like this is going to be in Target. I mean, this is, it looks like an item you see on Target shelves. So again, we're not sponsored by Target. I'm just saying it looks like something. It doesn't look like something you sell at Walmart or maybe Jewel-Osco. This definitely has like a Target vibe about the bottles.
Yeah, yeah. And again, they do look nice. So what our listeners don't see, I'll describe. The bottles are opaque with a screw top, a yellow one. So they're each a solid color, kind of chrome-ish in the reflection or their, I guess, texture. Yellow Pac-Man and then orange, red, you know, pink and blue for the ghosts. And each have a, I guess you'd call 8-bit authentic looking drawing of each of, you know, either the Pac-Man or the ghosts. So, are they different flavors or kinds? I can't tell. Or are they just different bottles?
I was wondering that too. I can't tell. Like you would think that they would have, like sake doesn't, it's not like, you know, here in America, these would be flavored vodkas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I could actually kind of see being made too. And it would be like lemon and orange and bubble. There probably is bubblegum flavored vodka, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, blueberry, raspberry, and plain. Hold on, I'm Googling bubblegum vodka.
No, I know it exists. There's a vodka bar in Detroit that I've seen it at.
Really? Yeah, look at that. Three olives bubble vodka. It looks like penicillin.
I like sake, but I don't know anything about it.
Hmm. Yeah, I've only tried it a little bit. I guess I just maybe I was not into harder drinks then because I did not care for it. But I feel like I could get into it. It's a weird goal to like say I want to get into this particular form of hard liquor. But...
No, I'm totally with you. If any of our listeners are traveling to Japan or have friends that are traveling to Japan, I will give you money to bring this back. I know that's a very strange breaking the fourth wall host to listener, but that's how much I want these.
Okay, so now what if Sonic the Hedgehog was making an alcohol?
Well, we're getting close there. They're making an energy drink.
Yeah, not this. I know you can add vodka to the energy drink, and many people do. But I'm saying, like, if you were going to make something based on Sonic, what would be your base liquor?
Oh, man. I think it would have to be... I think I would go vodka, because you could kind of mix it with everything. Right?
Yeah, I guess.
And I think I thought that because, like, the vodka and Red Bull is a thing, right? Or am I getting that wrong?
Well, yes, vodka and Red Bull is a real thing.
But this is
regrettably, it is a real thing, yes.
If you're ready for a vomit reflex, this is by G Fuel. And if you haven't read this yet, take a guess. What do you think the flavor is? Have you read it?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so, don't look. What do you think the flavor?
Energy drinks all taste terrible, and they're always some combination of bad
things. All taste like liquid Pez, yeah.
So it's going to be like cactus and blueberry.
Peach rings.
Hmm.
Yep.
All right, so are you familiar with, they don't make it anymore, do they? There was like a, Seagram's did like a blue gin at some point. That's what I'm thinking for Sonic the Hedgehog.
See, that would make sense. Peach rings. But, I do not want this. If you buy a special edition, you could get a little tumbler with it too, a little shaker cup. So I guess you can mix it up with stuff.
Yeah, so they know what you're doing with that drink.
Yes. I would much rather have Pac-Man sake.
Yes. Than
Sonic G Fuel. There's zero sugar though, but you don't want to know what the other stuff is.
What about like a Sonic malt liquor?
No, it just doesn't make sense.
Okay, what game gets the malt liquor then?
Hmm.
Not Mario. Like, I don't see that. It's got to be something kind of, you know, like Because that'd be something cheap. Like, I could see Atari malt liquor.
Definitely. You can only buy with Atari coins.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Mario would get gin or something like that.
Well, Mario's a plumber. Wouldn't he get the what's that, Italian Limon, something like that?
Oh, yeah.
That's what you have to do for Mario. Nintendo's not going to cross-promote Mario with alcohol. That's why I crossed that one off already.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Atari Jaguar malt liquor. That's what I'm thinking.
Oh. Yeah. And it would say, it would give you the alcohol content, and then it would say, do the math.
Yeah. Yeah. But the alcohol content's actually a lie. It's actually half the alcohol content it claims to be.
That's right. Yeah. I think we're onto something.
All right. We don't have, because you're about to go on vacation. I literally just woke up. We have a kind of improvised topic about running RetroArch, or possibly RetroArch, on the Vita.
Yeah, so in the past, I've installed RetroArch on the Vita. Recently, RetroArch got a huge Vita update that we reported on that it has a lot more video acceleration, or I guess GPU acceleration. So now is the time to hack your Vitas. So I just wanted to give a quick overview. And this is going to be very quick. I'm going to have show notes for people who actually want to do this, because it's pretty boring to talk about the actual process. But in a nutshell, you download a certain application that installs one program on your Vita, which is called H-Encore. And what that program does is pretty much roots your Vita. From there, you install something called Vita Shell, which is like the core of Vita hacking. And that gives you like better USB access. You can see the file system. And also, it has a built-in FTP server. So you could just drag and drop stuff to your Vita. From there, you can download VPKs, which are Vita programs. So it could be, you know, a Vita game, or it could be RetroArch, or, you know, really anything. So,
real quick, do you have to have like a unpatched Vita? Does it have to be a particular model without like latest updates?
It could be any model. The lower the firmware, the better. But the last I read, at least the second to latest firmware works. I'm pretty sure they've got the latest firmware working. And the first step, getting H-Encore on there, is the most annoying part. But after you get past that, you're good to go. You can, from libretro, just download the RetroArch VBK, or I'm not going to put this in the show notes or anything like that, but if you Google for Vita Ultimate Retro, you will find a 256 download with 250, I think it's like 200 gigs worth of retro games plus RetroArch on there that has all the overlays, all the artwork for all the games, and it's all good to go for you. You just drag and drop all that in there. It's like three simple steps. The only thing it doesn't have is Nintendo 64, because that's very new that you can emulate Nintendo 64 and have it work fine on the Vita. I would say the only caveat with this is one of the programs you install on your Vita as you're hacking it after H-Encore is Henkaku, H-E-N-K-A-K-U. And anytime your Vita reboots, you have to run this program or nothing will load. So that's really the only annoying part, is you have to press one extra button after your Vita reboots. but you'd be shocked at how many times you forget you have to do that and think you've bricked your Vita. But that's a very, very short topic of the week. This topic is going to be very show notes intensive. So if you're interested in this or if you've ever done this, you know, email us how it goes for you. Email at retrogameclub.net. We'd love to hear about it. Like you said, I'm going on vacation starting now. And I got my Vita ready to go. It is going to be what I'm going to be gaming on. I mean, I'm bringing my Switch too, but I plan on spending some time with retro stuff on it. So
cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I do want to say that the Vita is kind of the perfect size. You know, you don't want to mess with your Switch. Like, you can hack that, but it's new and it's so pretty. You know, you don't want to break your Switch. Vitas you could get for a good price now, and it's gotten easier to do. And it's pretty much a PS3, right?
Yeah,
so they're powerful enough to play all this stuff, especially with all the 3D work going on. And the reason why the 3D work took so long is the Vita has its own 3D driver. It does not use OpenGL, which is strange. So it's like a layer this person put between OpenGL, which all the cores use, and the Vita. So yeah. So that is that. We got some game club.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The whole reason we're here. Yeah, so I picked Pilotwing 64. Obviously, Dan Hess from the previous episode did the sound in this. And yeah, it's a flight sim. I considered a bunch of mini games where you're, you know, on a jetpack or a little helicopter or a hang glider. And you have to go through rings and do a perfect landing and take pictures and yada, yada, yada. And the better you do, the more points you get. And the higher medal you could get to move on to the next level. And there's even like some target practice and stuff like that. This was a, like we said in the previous episode, launch game for the Nintendo 64, which I did get at launch. And yeah, it brought back a bunch of memories. All good, I think. It plays great. It's smooth. It looks great. It actually looks better than I remember. And I did play this on the Nintendo 64. I did not emulate and upscale or anything like that. And obviously, like we talked about for an hour last episode, the soundtrack is incredible. Yeah, it's just a fantastic game. You have anything you want to add to this?
No, I don't own this game. So
what?
No, I don't. Oh, I only have like a dozen Nintendo 64 games. Well, I guess more than that. Although I look at my
this
collection.
Just feels like one that comes in every pack you get from eBay or something. You know what I mean? Or every garage sale.
Yeah, no, I somehow don't have it. I did go and listen to the soundtrack though after your interview, and it is indeed very good. That's mostly what I have to add. Yeah, very good soundtrack.
Yeah.
I will probably stumble whenever there's yard sales again. Maybe I'll get a copy. I didn't like go on eBay to see what it goes for or anything.
It is, yeah. You will like this game. And I definitely think, I don't really like SNES Pilot Wings. Nothing against it. But, yeah. This, I think you'll really like.
Yeah, that I definitely have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, this isn't a real expensive game on eBay, so.
What's it going for?
Loose copies are like $8, $5 to $8.
Yeah, because they made so many of them, you know. It was the only game you could buy for the longest time.
Somebody is selling the boxed Japanese version for $19.96, and it looks like they have $19.66. Sorry, don't add the extra 30 cents plus $6 shipping. And it looks like they just bought like a warehouse of them.
Nice.
So, if you want a box copy with some really interesting artwork, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, isn't this on like Wii and, or is that a different version on Wii?
That's a different game. The Wii or yeah. Yeah. That's a
Resort. Game. Yeah.
Yeah. Different game.
Yeah. Yeah. And then something on the 3DS as well. So lots of ways to play at least some type of Pilot Wings, but yeah. Let's jump to your game.
Yeah, so I went with Streets of Rage 2 just because it's been on my regular soundtrack rotation recently. Mm-hmm. It's a Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack, of mm-hmm. course. And this is on every Genesis collection ever made, as far as I can tell. darn near every Genesis collection ever made. And it's just a straight-up brawler. You know, you've got a couple different characters to choose from. I always go with the with Skate. So that's my favorite because I like the fast characters. Have you? Which character do you go with?
Same. Yep.
Yeah, and they have the kind of funny attack. You can, like, jump up on your opponent's shoulders and whack him in the back of the head a few times, which seems like that would KO most people, but it doesn't always.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't, you can, like, kick them in the face with a rollerblade, which I also think would knock out most people. But again, you know, it's video game laws, right? I mean, this is where, you know, people can, like, kick a tank until it explodes, right? So,
yeah.
I don't use Max or the other one, Blaze, all that much. Just never to stick with the same character all the time. And, yeah, what is it, like 8 stages? I usually, you know, as much as I like the game, I usually get to about stage 4 or 5 before I'm like, all right, I've had my fill of fighting people. I think one time I did a full playthrough to... How was it, like, the secret, you know, well, not the secret base, because the last boss is, like, in, I don't know, like, a skyscraper or something. Like, you know, they're an evil crime syndicate, and he has his own skyscraper somewhere. And there's, like, aliens, and it's really crazy, but it is fun. Like, I think once in your life, you should probably play all the way through Streets of Rage 2, and then from there, I guess you can take a break after that.
This music in this game, I don't know how they did that on the Genesis. It sounds like almost like samples and stuff. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are samples in it. Like, that's kind of the vibe you get about a lot of Yuzo Koshiro soundtracks on Sega Genesis, because like Revenge of Shinobi has that kind of feel to it too. Mm-hmm. Of like how did they fit this onto a game, right? And also, I'm trying to see what else he worked on for Genesis at least. So yeah, so first of all, the soundtrack reminds me a lot. Like, there's a game he worked on called Misty Blue that was never released in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But the soundtrack is out there, and the soundtrack sounds a lot like this. And that was like a PC game. And that came out in, like, I don't know, 1990, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Genesis, of course, it's like Streets of Rage, Streets of Rage 2, Revenge of Shinobi. And I think Batman Returns is the other Genesis game he worked on.
Really?
Huh. Yeah, or did he only work on the... I think... He might have only done... No, you know, I take that back. He might have done the Master System. Because he also was doing, like, Master System soundtracks around this time. Because he did, like, Sonic the Hedgehog for Master System or Game Gear, but not... for Genesis.
Really?
Just totally random. And then, you know, went on to do like a bunch of Super Nintendo games. And even now he has tracks on, like, you know, Smash Brothers and Shenmue and that kind of stuff. I mean, he's done a ton of stuff. And of course, Streets of Rage 4.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, yep. I mean, the soundtrack to me is like better than the game. Like, it's a fun brawler. Like I said, I admit to getting burned out after 3 or 4 stages, but the soundtrack just doesn't get old.
Yeah, it is fantastic. Now, did you order Streets of Rage 4?
I did not.
I caved in. I did the Limited Run games. I think I did it on while we were recording one time.
Yeah, I think you did, yeah. I think I remember.
But I always like these games better than... I don't know why I always kind of compare them to... Oh, I do know why. I kind of compare them to the Double Dragon games. Mm-hmm. And I just think these kind of do it better.
Yeah, they're a lot faster. Double Dragon yeah. seems very kind of slow paced compared to Streets of Rage.
Yeah, yeah, and these just have much better backgrounds as well. Mm-hmm. Well, what are you going to do next?
I'm going to do a game that I've wanted to try for a while and just haven't got around to starting. That is Soul Blazer. So Soul Blazer is a game by a couple of the people that worked on the first East game. And is also like sort of an action RPG.
What could people play this on?
It is only on Super Nintendo.
Okay. I am going to do Dan Hess's pick, Toe Jam and Earl.
Sounds good.
Is that on? That's got to be on some collections.
It's on many collections. That's what I've okay. I don't own a copy of this, but I played it on collections. Okay. And I've never really been able to figure out what's going on in this game. So I guess I should I should actually try it, huh?
Well, like I said, while we were talking to Dan, the interview on the Retro Hour is fantastic. I would definitely. I'm assuming you've listened to it, but I think it was one of the older ones. But if any listener wants to. Get a little schooling about Toe Jam and Earl. Definitely give that a listen.
Yeah, I don't recall if I heard that one.
But if any of our listeners play any of these games, email at retrogameclub.net. Eric from the Pacific Northwest emails us. He was happy he heard himself mentioned on the last podcast. It's funny. In regards to the Ace card on the DS Lite, he said he had no issues with it. That's... an SD card ROM loader that we talked about in the last episode. And he says, yeah, he's been using it in a few years and it's been working. And Robert writes in very nice words from him saying he always makes our podcast jump to the front of the list. Thank you very much. It's a very nice thing to say. He was watching a Pilot Wing 64 long play and it reminded him of the N64 release and many memories from it. Him and his friends were 16 and they stayed up the night before for the release, driving back and forth to see if the line had formed at the local Target and everyone could take a drink. We mentioned Target again. Mm-hmm. The store only received 5 copies, so they were outside handing out tickets. Two of his friends bought it, but he was broke that day. When they got home, they played Mario 64. Though now that he thinks of it, Pilot Wings and Mario 64 were released before the console, so they were...
That's so true.
They had those waiting.
Yeah, I think there's one or two other cases where games came out before the console. I think there's at least one other example of that, although I'm drawing a blank now.
A game came out before the console.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. This probably happened when I was working the store, too. Like, no, it wouldn't be a big system. It'd be like we got, you know, Dino Dudes for Jaguar before the console came in, you know, something like that. That's not a real example. I think the Jaguar console came in the same day the games did.
But there's not that many consoles, so I'm trying to think what it could be.
Yeah, but you forget in the 90s, there were a lot of, like, really short-lived kind of garbage consoles. There were a lot of really, like, ones that were just around for, like, a year or two.
Like the... Virtual Boys of the World.
Yeah, I mean, Virtual Boy was like exactly a year. Just a lot of like, oh, I got it. Let me look at this handy reference that some dude wrote. So stuff like the Tandy VIS. A 3DO, I guess, lasted more than a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But like Neo Geo CD, Jaguar CD, Philips CDI, of course, 32X. You know, just a lot of like... and then later on, like the GameCom, that was like late 90s. You know, things that were just like around for a short period of time. And it wouldn't surprise me if like stores just happened to randomly get a game or two without getting the system.
Yeah.
Oh, the Pippin. How can I forget the Pippin?
It's very easy to forget the Pippin. That's one thing I don't even want to emulate. I just do not care.
Right. Like I once heard someone make a comment to the effect of like, if Apple made a game console, it would cost twice as much as the PlayStation 4, but have half the power. And I'm like, Apple did this in the 90s. It was called the Pippin. And it cost twice as much and had half the power. Like,
yeah.
That's what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. Joe writes about a few topics here. On the topic of visually appealing console designs, he agrees the Master System looks great, although the packaging, the box, looks like business productivity software. But the system itself is very, very slick looking. And the NES looks okay, but he says he makes a good analogy of the NES looking like R2-D2 while the Master System looks like Darth Vader. Which,
yeah. I never thought about that.
Yeah, I think that's completely accurate. He enjoyed the interview with Dan Hess. He thinks sound design, especially working sound effects, is an overlooked part of game design. Mm-hmm. And doesn't think games like Pac-Man or Mario Brothers would be as memorable without great sound design, and that is true. On Pilot Wings, the games always seem to be more of a way to show off the system. Which, yeah, that's a good observation. First one showed off the Mode 7, while the second one was a showcase for the N64's 3D capabilities. Mm-hmm. It's kind of surprising in retrospect they didn't do a version on the Wii that just used the motion controls in Mii avatars.
So, like, you would have your arms spread out. You'd be, like, flapping your arms.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I can completely see Nintendo doing that. I could even see them doing that with the Switch. Coincidentally, he's been playing Streets of Rage 2 lately. It's a fun beat-em-up, although it goes off the rails around the amusement park stage when you go through some weird alien-themed ride for a reason. He likes Final Fight better because he thinks the characters and visuals are more interesting, but Streets of Rage 2 is better in the soundtrack apartment 2. And it's very similar to, like, dance music of that era.
I always, while talking about beat-em-up games, I always confuse Streets of Rage with Final Fight. I've done it on this podcast before. You've corrected me at least twice.
Nice.
Thank you for those emails, everyone. If you want to email us, email at retrogameclub.net or hit us up on Facebook without seeing all the political stuff and whatever by going to facebook.retrogameclub.net or Twitter at RGC Podcasts. Our buddy Zach runs all those for us, and I chime in every once in a while. There was a question, what was your favorite beat-em-up brawler? And Code Monkey WB actually emailed us about it. But he didn't go retro, but I still like these answers. He's a huge fan of beat-em-ups. He enjoyed Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and River City Girls, which I haven't played that one. Both games have excellent soundtracks, a fun story, and their moves are easy to learn, and it just keeps it fresh. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so that was our sole social media answer that Scott curated for us this time. So, yeah, again, that's email at retrogameclub.net, facebook.retrogameclub.net, or at RGC Podcast. And I think that wraps up Season 2, Episode 21.
Yeah. So thanks for listening.